Random House Audio presents Q is for Quarry by Sue Grafton. Read for you by Judy Kay. Q is for Quarry. Chapter 1. It was Wednesday, the second week in April, and Santa Teresa was making a wanton display of herself. The lush green of winter, with its surfeit of magenta and salmon bougainvillea, had erupted anew in a splashy show of crocuses, hyacinths, and flowering plum trees. The skies were a mild blue, the air balmy and fragrant. Violets dotted the grass. I was tired of spending my days closeted in the Hall of Records, searching out grant deeds and tax liens for clients who were, doubtless, happily pursuing tennis, golf, and other idle amusements. I suppose I was suffering from a mutant, possibly incurable form of spring fever, which consisted of feeling bored, restless, and disconnected from humanity at large. My name is Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private detective in Santa Teresa, California, 95 miles north of Los Angeles. I'd be turning 37 on May 5th, which was coming up in 4 weeks, an event that was probably contributing to my general malaise. I lead a stripped-down existence, untroubled by bairn, pets, or living household plants. On February 15th, 2 months before, I'd moved into new offices, having separated myself from my association with the law firm of Kingman and Ives. Lonnie Kingman had purchased a building on Lower State Street, and though he'd offered to take me with him, I felt it was time to be out on my own. That was my first mistake. My second was an unfortunate encounter with two landlords in a deal that went sour and left me out in the cold. My third office-related error was the one I now faced. In desperation, I'd rented space in a nondescript cottage on Caballeria Lane, where a row of identical stucco bungalows were lined up at the curb like the three little pigs. The block, short, narrow, and lined with cars, ran between Santa Teresa Street and Arbor, a block north of Via Madrina, in the heart of downtown. While the price was right and the location was excellent, in easy walking distance of the courthouse, the police station, and the public library, the office itself fell woefully short of ideal. The interior consisted of two rooms, the larger I designated as my office proper. The smaller I was using as a combination library and reception area. In addition, there was a galley-style kitchen where I kept a small refrigerator, my coffee pot, and my Sparklets water dispenser. There was also a small, fusty half-bath with a sorrowful-looking toilet and sink. The whole of it smelled like mildew, and I suspected at night wee creatures scuttled around the baseboards after all the lights were turned off. By way of compensation, the building's owner had offered unlimited cans of an off-brand paint, and I'd spent the better part of a week rolling coats of white latex over the former pulsating pink, a shade reminiscent of internal organs at work. He'd also agreed to have the rugs cleaned, not that anyone could tell. The beige, high-low, wall-to-wall nylon carpeting was matted from long wear and seemed to be infused with despair. I'd arranged and rearranged my desk, my swivel chair, my file cabinets, sofa, and assorted artificial plants. Nothing dispelled the general air of weariness that infected the place. I had plenty of money in savings, 25,000 bucks if it's anybody's business. So in theory, I could have held out for much classier digs. On the other hand, at $350 a month, the space was affordable and satisfied one of my basic principles in life, which is never, never, never to live beyond my means. I don't want to be compelled to take on work to meet my overhead. The office is meant to serve me, not the other way around. Since the bungalows on either side of mine were vacant, I was feeling isolated, which may account for a newfound ambivalence about my single status in a world of married folk. Except for two brief failed marriages, I'd been unattached for most of my natural life. This had never bothered me. More often than not, I rejoiced in my freedom, my mobility, and my solitude. Lately, circumstances had conspired to unsettle my habitual content. Earlier that week, I'd encountered my friend Vera with her husband, Dr. Neil Hess. I was sneaking in a late afternoon jog on the bike path at the beach when I spotted them sauntering along ahead of me. Vera was a former employee of California Fidelity Insurance, for which I had also worked. She'd met Neil, decided he was too short for her, and tried passing him off on me. I knew at a glance they were smitten with each other, and despite protests to the contrary, I'd persuaded her that he was her perfect match, which had turned out to be true. The two of them were accompanied that afternoon by their 18-month-old son in his stroller and a grinning golden retriever pup, frolicking and prancing, tugging at his leash. Vera, massive, lumbering, milky, and serene, was clearly expecting again, apparently in mere days, judging by her swollen state. We paused to chat, and I realized that in the 3.5 years since I'd last seen her, my life hadn't changed a whit. Same apartment, same car, same work, same boyfriend in absentia in a relationship that was going no place. The revelation generated a prolonged pang of regret. Meanwhile, Henry, my beloved landlord, was off cruising the Caribbean in the company of his siblings and his sister-in-law, Rosie, who owns the tavern half a block from my apartment. I'd been bringing in his mail, watering his houseplants once a week and his yard every couple of days. Rosie's restaurant would be closed for another 5 days, so until the three of them returned home, I couldn't even have supper in familiar surroundings. I know all of this sounds ever so faintly like whining, but I feel morally obliged to tell the truth. That Wednesday morning, I'd decided my attitude would greatly improve if I quit feeling sorry for myself and got my office squared away. To that end, I'd gone to a thrift store and purchased 2 additional used file cabinets, an upright wooden cupboard with assorted pigeonholes, and a funky painted armoire to house my accumulation of office supplies. I was perched on a low stool surrounded by cartons I hadn't unpacked since I'd moved into Lonnie's office 3.5 years before. This felt a little bit like Christmas in that I was discovering items I'd long forgotten I had. I just reached the bottom of box number 3, of a total of 8, when I heard a knock at the door. I yelled, "I'm here!" When I turned, Lieutenant Dolan was standing on the threshold, his hands sunk in the pockets of his tan raincoat. "Hey, what are you doing here? It's been months." I got up and dusted my hand on the seat of my jeans before extending it to him. His grip was strong and warm, his smile almost sheepish, as pleased to see me as I was to see him.
"I ran into Lonnie at the courthouse. He said you'd rented this place, so I thought I'd pop in."
"That's great. I appreciate the visit."
"I see you're getting settled."
"About time. I moved in February 15th and haven't done a thing."
"I hear business is slow."
"It is, at least the kind of jobs I like." I watched while Con Dolan made a circuit of the room. He seemed ill at ease and covered his discomfort by wading through a steady stream of small talk. He chatted idly about Lonnie, the weather, and miscellaneous matters, while I made what I hoped were the appropriate responses. I couldn't imagine what he wanted, but I assumed he'd get down to his purpose in due course. He'd never been the type to drop in unannounced. I'd known him for 10 years, the greater portion of which he'd headed up the homicide unit of the Santa Teresa Police Department. He was currently out on a medical disability, sidelined by a series of heart attacks. I'd heard he was eager to return to work full-time. According to the scuttlebutt, his chances ran somewhere between slim and none. He paused to check out the inner office, glanced into the half-bath, and then circled back in my direction.
"Lonnie said you weren't crazy about the place, and I can see your point. It's grim."
"Isn't it? I can't figure it out. I know it needs something, but I can't think what."
"You need art."
"You think so?" I let my gaze trace the bare white walls.
"Sure. Get yourself some big travel posters and some double-sided tape. It'd perk the place right up. Failing that, you might at least wipe the dust off the artificial plants."
He was in his early 60s, and his cardiac problems had left his complexion looking sour. The usual bags under his eyes had turned a dark, smoky shade, making his whole face seem sunken in circulatory gloom. He was apparently marking the time away from the department by shaving every other day, and this wasn't the one. His face had tended to be pouchy in the best of times, but now his mouth was pulled down in a permanent expression of malcontent. Just my kind of guy. I could tell he was still smoking because his raincoat, when he moved, smelled of nicotine. The last time I remembered seeing him, he was in a hospital bed. The visit had been awkward. Up to that point, I'd always been intimidated by the man. But then I'd never seen him in a cotton hospital nightie with his puckered butt on display through a slit down the back. I'd felt friendlier toward him since. I knew he liked me, despite the fact his manner in the past had alternated between surly and abrupt. I said, "So, what's up? I can't believe you walked all the way over here to give me decorating tips."
"Actually, I'm on my way to lunch and thought you might join me. If you're free, that is."
I glanced at my watch. It was only 10:25. "Sure, I could do that. Let me get my bag and my jacket and I'll meet you out front." We took off on foot, walking to the corner where we turned right and headed north on Santa Teresa Street. I thought we'd be going to the Del Mar or the Arcade, two restaurants where guys from the PD gravitated for lunch. Instead, we soldiered on for another three blocks and finally turned into a hole in the wall known as Sneaky Pete's, though the name on the entrance sign said something else. The place was largely empty, one couple at a table and a smattering of day drinkers sitting at the far end of the bar. Dolan took a seat at the near end, and I settled myself on the stool to his left. The bartender laid her cigarette in an ashtray, reached for a bottle of Old Forester, and poured him a drink before he opened his mouth. He paused to light a cigarette, and then he caught my look.
"What?"
"Well, gee, Lieutenant Dolan, I was just wondering if this was part of your cardiac rehabilitation." He turned to the bartender.
"She thinks I don't take very good care of myself."
She placed the glass in front of him. "Wonder where she got that?" I pegged her in her 40s. She had dark hair that she wore pulled away from her face and secured by tortoiseshell combs. I could see a few strands of gray. Not a lot of makeup, but she looked like someone you could trust in a bartenderly sort of way. "What can I do for you?" "I'll have a Coke." Dolan cocked his thumb at me.
"Kinsey Milhone. She's a PI in town. We're having lunch."
"Tanny Ottweiler," she said, introducing herself. "Nice to meet you."
We shook hands, and then she reached down and came up with two sets of cutlery encased in paper napkins that she placed in front of us.
"You sitting here?"
Dolan tilted his head.
"We'll take that table by the window."
"I'll be there momentarily."
Dolan tucked a cigarette in his mouth, the smoke causing his right eye to squint as he picked up his whiskey and moved away from the bar. I followed, noting that he'd chosen a spot as far from the other drinkers as he could get. We sat down, and I set my handbag on a nearby chair. "Is there a menu?" He shed his raincoat and took a sip of whiskey.
"The only thing worth ordering is a spicy salami on a Kaiser roll with melted pepper jack. Damn thing'll knock your socks off. Tanny puts a fried egg on top."
Sounds great." Tanny appeared with my Coke. There was a brief time out while Dolan ordered our sandwiches. As we waited for lunch, I said, "So, what's going on?" He shifted in his seat, making a careful survey of the premises before his gaze returned to mine.
"You remember Stacy Oliphant? He retired from the sheriff's department maybe 8 years back. You must have met him."
"Oh, don't think so. I know who he is. Everybody talks about Stacy. But he'd left the department by the time I connected up with Shine and Bird." Morley Shine had been a private investigator in partnership with another private eye named Benjamin Bird. Both had been tight with the sheriff's office. They'd hired me in 1974 and trained me in the business while I acquired the hours I needed to apply for my license. "He must be in his 80s. Dolan shook his head.
"He's actually 73. As it turns out, being idle drove him out of his mind. He couldn't handle the stress, so he went back to the S.O. part-time, working cold cases for the Criminal Investigations Division."
"Nice."
"That part, yes. What's not nice is he's been diagnosed with cancer. Non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. This is the second time around for him. He was in remission for years, but the symptoms showed up again about 7 months ago. By the time he found out, it had progressed to stage 4, 5 being death, just so you get the drift. His long-term prognosis stinks. 20% survival rate if the treatment works, which it might not. He did 6 rounds of chemo and a passel of experimental drugs. Guy's been sick as a dog. Oh, it sounds awful. It is. He was pulling out of it some, and then recently he started feeling punk. They put him back in the hospital a couple of days ago. Blood tests showed severe anemia, so they decided to transfuse him. Then they decided while he was in, they might as well run more tests so they could see where he stands. He's a pessimist, of course, but to my way of thinking, there's always hope.
I'm sorry.
Not as sorry as I am. I've known him close to 40 years, longer than I knew my wife.
Dolan took a drag of a cigarette, reaching for a tin ashtray on the table next to us. He tapped off a fraction of an inch of ash.
How'd the two of you hook up? I thought he worked North County. You were PD down here.
He was already with the SO when our paths first crossed. This was 1948. I was from a blue-collar background, nothing educated or intellectual. I'd come out of the Army with an attitude, cocky and brash. 2 years I knocked around, not doing anything much. I finally got a job as a pump jockey at a gas station in Lompoc. Talk about a dead end. One night a guy came in and pulled a gun on the night manager. I was in the back room cleaning up at the end of my shift when I figured out what was going on. I grabbed a wrench, ducked out the side door, and came around the front. Guy was so busy watching to make sure my boss didn't call the cops, he never saw me coming. I popped him a good one and knocked him on his ass. Stacy was the deputy who arrested him. He's only 10 years older than me, but he's the closest thing to a mentor I ever had. He's the one talked me into law enforcement. I went to college on the GI Bill and then hired on with the PD as soon as a job opened up. He even introduced me to Grace, and I married her 6 months later.
Sounds like he changed the course of your life.
In more ways than one.
Does he have family in the area?
No close relatives. The guy never married. A while back, he was dating someone, if that's what you want to call it, at our advanced age. Nice gal, but somehow it didn't work out. Since Grace died, the two of us have spent a fair amount of time together. We go hunting and fishing any chance we get. Now that I'm out on medical, we've done a lot of that of late.
How's he dealing with all of this?
Up and down. Too much time on his hands and not a lot to do except brood. I can't tell you how many times I heard that one. Guy retires after 30 years and the next thing you know he gets sick and dies. Stacy doesn't say much about it, but I know how his mind works. He's depressed as hell.
Is he religious?
Not him. He claims he's an atheist, but we'll see about that. Me, I always went to church. At least while Gracie was alive. I don't see how you face death without believing in something. Otherwise, it makes no sense.
Dolan glanced up just as Tanny appeared with 2 large plates loaded with freshly made sandwiches and fries, plus 2 orders for the other table. Dolan interrupted his story to have a chat with her. I occupied myself with banging on the ketchup bottle until a thick drool of red covered the southeast corner of my fries. I knew he was leading up to something, but he was taking his sweet time. I lifted the top of the Kaiser roll and salted everything in sight. Biting in, I could feel the egg yolk oozing into the bun. The combination of spicy salami and snappy, pepper-hot jack cheese turned out to be the food equivalent of someone hollering, "Hot damn!" on the surface of my tongue. I made one of my food moans. Embarrassed, I looked up at them, but neither seemed to notice. When Tanny finally left, Dolan stubbed out his cigarette and paused for an extended bout of coughing so fierce it made his whole body shake. I pictured his lungs like a set of black cartoon bellows wheezing away. He shook his head.
Sorry about that. I had a bad cold a month ago, and it's been hard to shake.
He took a swallow of whiskey to soothe his irritated throat. He picked up his sandwich and continued his story between bites, taking up exactly where he'd left off.
While Stacy's been laid up, I've been doing what I can to get his apartment cleaned. Place is a mess. He should be out of the hospital tomorrow, and I didn't want him coming home to the sight of all that crap.
He set his sandwich down to light another cigarette, rolling it over to the corner of his mouth while he pulled out a cylinder of papers he'd tucked into his breast coat pocket.
Yesterday I went through a pile of papers on his kitchen table. I was hoping to come across the name of a friend I could contact, somebody to cheer him up. Stace could use a little something to look forward to. Anyway, there was nothing of that nature, but I did find this.
He placed the curling sheaf on the table in front of me. I finished my sandwich in one last bite and wiped my hands on a napkin before I reached for the papers. I knew at a glance it was a copy of a sheriff's department file. The cover page was marked 187 PC, indicating it was a homicide with a case number following. The pages were held together with fasteners, 65 or 70 sheets in all, with a set of handwritten notes inserted at the back. I returned to the cover page. Victim, Jane Doe. Found, Sunday, August 3rd, 1969. Location, Grayson Quarry, Highway 1, Lompoc. Under investigating officers, there were four names listed, one of them Stacy Oliphants. Dolan leaned forward.
You can see he was one of the original investigating officers. Stacy and me were the ones who found the body. We'd taken a jeep up there, parked off the side of the road to go deer hunting that day. I guess there's a gate across the road now, but the property was open back then. The minute we got out, we picked up the smell. We both knew what it was. Something dead for days. Didn't take us long to find out exactly what it was. She'd been flung down a short embankment like a sack of trash. This is the case he was working when he got sick. It's always bugged him they never figured out who she was, let alone who killed her.
I felt a dim stirring of memory. I remember this. Wasn't she stabbed and then dumped?
Right.
Seems odd they never managed to identify her.
He thought so, too. It's one of those cases really stuck in his craw. He kept thinking there was something he'd overlooked. He'd go back to it when he could, but he never made much progress.
And you're thinking what, to have another go at it?
If I can talk him into it, I think it'd make a world of difference in his attitude.
I leafed through the photocopies, watching the progression of dates and events. Looks like just about everything.
Including black and white prints of the crime scene photographs. He had another couple of files, but this is the one caught my eye.
He paused to wipe his mouth and then pushed his plate aside.
It'd give him a lift to get back into this and see about developing some information. He can act as lead detective while we do the legwork.
I found myself staring. You and me.
Sure, why not? We can pay for your time. For now, all I'm suggesting is the three of us sit down and talk. If he likes the idea, we'll go ahead. If not, I guess I'll come up with something else.
I tapped the file. Not to state the obvious, but this is 18 years old.
I know, but aside from Stacy's interest, there hasn't been a push on this since 1970 or so. What if we could crack it? Think what that'd do for him. It could make all the difference.
It was the first time I'd seen any animation in his face. I pretended to ponder, but there wasn't much debate. I was sick of doing paperwork. Enough already with the file searches and the background checks. Stacy still has access to the department?
Sure. A lot of folks out there think the world of him. We could probably get anything we need. Within reason, of course.
Let me take this home and read it. Dolan sat back, trying not to look too pleased.
I'll be over at Cece's from 6 until midnight. Show up by 8 and we can swing over to St. Terry's and bring Stacy up to speed.
I found myself smiling in response. Chapter 2. I spent the early part of the afternoon in my new office digs, hammering away on my portable Smith Corona. I typed up 2 overdue reports, did my filing, prepared invoices, and cleaned off my desk. I started in on the bills at 3, and by 3:35 I was writing out the final check, which I tore from my checkbook.
I tucked it in the return envelope, then licked the flap so carelessly I nearly paper-cut my tongue. That done, I went into the outer office and moved all the unpacked boxes back into the closet. Nothing like a little motivation to get the lead out of your butt. My supper that night consisted of a peanut butter and pickle sandwich accompanied by Diet Pepsi over ice. I ate in my minuscule living room, curled up on the sofa, tucked into the window bay. In lieu of dinnerware, I used a fold of paper toweling that doubled as a dainty lip wipe when I'd finished my meal. With spring on the move, it was not quite dark out. The air was still chilly, especially once the sun went down. Through the partially opened window, I could hear a distant lawnmower and the occasional fragment of conversation as assorted people walked by. I live a block from the beach on a side street that provides overflow parking when Cabana Boulevard gets jammed. I slid down comfortably on my spine, my sock feet on the coffee table, while I settled into work. I went through the file quickly at first, just to get the lay of the land. A detective named Brad Krause was lead investigator on the case. The other investigating officers, aside from Stacy Oliphant, were Detective Keith Baldwin, Sergeant Oscar Wallen, Sergeant Melvin Galloway, and Deputy Joe Mandel. A lot of manpower. Krause had typed the bulk of the reports using multiple carbons, which Stacy had apparently then photocopied from the old murder book. Judging from the number of strikeovers, I had to guess Detective Krause had not been first in his class in secretarial school. I fancied if I put my ear to the page, I'd pick up the churlish echoes of his long-ago curses embedded in the lines of print. It's odd going through an old file, like reading a mystery novel where you spoil the ending for yourself by peeking ahead to the very last page. The final document, a letter from a soils expert in San Pedro, California, was dated September 28, 1971, and indicated that the sample submitted by the Santa Teresa County Sheriff's Department would be impossible to distinguish from samples taken from similar deposits across the state. Sincerely, so sorry. End of the line for you, bub. I went back to the beginning and started reading again, this time taking notes. According to the first officer at the scene, the girl's body had been rolled over the edge of an embankment, coming to rest about 15 feet down, some 50 feet from the highway. Con Dolan and Stacy Oliphant had spotted her at approximately 5 p.m. on that Sunday, 1700 hours if you're talking military time, as this report did. She was lying on her left side on a crumpled canvas tarp, her hands bound in front of her with a length of white plastic-coated wire. She was wearing a dark blue Dacron blouse, white cotton pants with a print of dark blue daisies with a dot of red in each center. There was a leather sandal on her right foot. The matching sandal was found in the brush a short distance away. Marks in the dirt suggested she'd been dragged across the grass near the road. Even from the top of the slope, Dolan and Oliphant could see numerous stab wounds in her chest. It was also apparent her throat had been slashed. Oliphant had made immediate CB contact with the Lompoc PD. Because the location was in the county, two on-duty sheriff's deputies were dispatched to the scene. Deputy Joe Mandel and Sergeant Melvin Galloway arrived 20 minutes after the initial call. Photographs were taken of the decedent and of the surrounding area. The body was then removed to a Lompoc mortuary, pending arrival of the coroner. Meanwhile, the deputies searched the vicinity, took soil samples, bagged the tarpaulin along with a nearby broken shrub and two pieces of shrub stem that appeared to be stained with blood. On Tuesday, August 5, 1969, Mandel and Galloway returned to the crime scene to take measurements. The distance from the highway to the spot where the body had been found, the width of the blacktop, the location of the stray sandal. Sergeant Galloway took additional photos of the various areas showing the embankment, damaged shrubs, and drag marks. There were no crime scene sketches, but perhaps they'd become separated from the rest of the file in the intervening years. It took a minute to sort through the photographs, which were few in number and remarkably uninformative. 8 black and white prints, including one of the roadway, one of an officer pointing at a broken shrub, one of the embankment where the body was found, and 4 of the body from a distance of 15 feet. There were no close-ups of Jane Doe's face, no views of her wounds, or the knotted wire with which her hands had been bound. The tarp was visible beneath her, but it was difficult to judge how much of the body, if any, had been covered. Times have changed.
Current practice would have dictated 50 such photographs along with a video and a detailed crime scene sketch. In the same envelope, I found an additional 5 photographs in faded color showing the girl's sandals, pants, shirt, bra, and panties laid out on what looked like a sheet of white paper. The autopsy had been performed on August 4, 1969 at 10:30 a.m. I squinted, inferred, surmised, and otherwise faked my way through the report, deciphering enough of the technical talk to figure out what was being said. Because her body was in a state of advanced decomposition, the measurements were estimates. The girl's height was calculated at 63 to 65 inches, her weight at 120 to 125 pounds. Her eyes were blue, her hair dyed a reddish blonde that showed dark roots. In the left earlobe she wore a thin gold wire circle with a horseshoe configuration. In her right earlobe she wore a similar gold wire loop with a bent clip in its lower end. Her facial characteristics were indistinguishable due to skin slippage, gas crepitation, and decomposition. Examination of the body showed 8 deep stab wounds in the middle of the back below the shoulder blade area, 2 stab wounds at the base of the neck on either side, 5 stab wounds between her breasts, and a large stab wound under the left breast, which had penetrated the heart. There was considerable maggot activity. Because of decomposition, the pathologist was unable to ascertain the presence of any scars or identifying marks. There were no skeletal fractures or deformities, no visible injuries to the external genitalia. Her fallopian tubes and ovaries were unremarkable, and her uterine cavity was empty. Cause of death was listed as multiple stab wounds of the neck, chest, heart, and lungs. At the conclusion of his exam, the pathologist removed Jane Doe's fingers, the nails of which she had painted with silver polish. These were tagged by an officer and turned over for shipping to the FBI Identification Division in Washington, D.C. Films taken of her upper and lower jaws showed multiple metallic restorations. She also suffered from what is commonly referred to as buck teeth, with one crooked eye tooth on the left side. A dentist consulted later suggested that the extensive dental work had probably been done in the 2 years before her death, that being 1967 through 1968. He judged her to be in her late teens to early 20s. A forensic odontist, examining the maxilla and mandible at a later date, narrowed the girl's age to 15 years, plus or minus 36 months, noting that she probably died before she reached the legal age of 18. On Wednesday, August 6th, Sergeant Galloway submitted the following clothing and evidence to the deputy in charge of the property room. Number 1. One navy blue, full-length, puffed sleeve blouse of Dacron voile material, make unknown, blood-stained. Number 2. One pair home-sewn female white pants with blue flowers with red centers, size unknown. Number 3. One pair bikini panties, pink, size medium, pennies label. Number 4. One black bra, size 38A, Lady Suzanne label. Number 5. One pair female brown leather sandals, buckle type, with 4 brass links on leather straps, size 7.5, with gold letters made in Italy on inner sole. Number 6. One soiled canvas tarpaulin with blood and miscellaneous stains. The dead girl's earrings, a clipping of her hair, and the plastic-coated wire taken from her wrists were also booked into evidence. The sheriff's department must have sent the essential information about the deceased to other law enforcement agencies, because a series of follow-up reports over the next several weeks covered all manner of missing persons believed to match the description of Jane Doe. 3 stolen automobiles were recovered in the area, one containing assorted articles of women's clothing in the rear seat. This turned out to be unrelated, according to handwritten notes entered at a later date. The second vehicle, a 1966 red Mustang convertible with Arizona plates, reported stolen from an auto upholstery shop in Quorum, California, was subsequently returned to its rightful owner. The third stolen vehicle, a red 1967 Chevrolet, was tied to a homicide in Venice, California. The driver was subsequently arrested and later convicted of that crime. A vagrant was picked up for questioning but released. There was also a report of a 25-year-old employee who absconded with $46.35 in currency and change stolen from a service station on or outside the town of Seagate. The caretaker at a nearby state beach park was contacted and questioned about any persons he might have seen in the area. He reported nothing unusual. In three separate incidents, hitchhikers were picked up for questioning, but none of them were held. This was the summer of 1969, and there was a steady stream of hippies migrating north along this route. Hippies were generally regarded with suspicion, assumed to be high on drugs, which was probably the case. At 10:30 a.m. on August 6, 1969, Detective Krause interviewed a clerk named Roxanne Fott, who worked at a mini-mart on Highway 101. She'd contacted the sheriff's department after reading about the murder in the papers and reported that on Friday, August 1st, she'd seen a young girl who matched the description of Jane Doe. Miss Fott stated that the girl had helped herself to coffee and a donut, which she was unable to pay for. Fott paid for them herself, which is why the incident stuck in her mind. Earlier, she'd noticed the same girl hitchhiking north. However, she was gone when Fott left work at 3 p.m. The girl in the mini-mart carried no luggage and had no wallet or purse. Several other people contacted the department with leads, but none of these panned out. As the days went on, calls came in reporting vehicles of various makes, models, and descriptions that had been seen near the quarry both before and after the body was discovered. As with any investigation, delving into the one crime seemed to bring a number of peripheral crimes into focus. Loitering, trespassing, public drunkenness, petty theft, all of which turned out to be immaterial to the case. It was clear that many local citizens were busy remembering odd and freakish incidents that had occurred in the weeks prior to the homicide. For all anyone knew, one of these reports might hold a vital clue about the girl who'd been murdered or the person or persons who'd killed her. Every phone call, every out-of-state inquiry, and every rumor was dutifully tracked down. At the end of each report, there was a list appended giving the names, addresses, and phone numbers of those who'd been interviewed. The managers of the JCPenney stores in Lompoc and Santa Teresa were contacted with regard to the article of clothing that bore the Penny's label, but it was learned that the item was available at any store in the chain. In the end, the girl remained unidentified, and as autumn rolled into winter, new leads diminished. The stained canvas tarp bore no identifying labels. The plastic-coated wire was submitted to the crime lab for analysis. The lab determined that wiring of that nature would most probably be utilized in low-voltage amperage conditions where little or no tension would be exerted on its length and where maximum protection from abrasion and moisture was required, perhaps an autolight system or small low-voltage lighting equipment. By December of 1970, the intervals between reports had lengthened and new information had dwindled. Stacy had worked the case at various times during the following years. He'd consolidated the list of witnesses, and it looked as though he'd arranged them in order of their importance, at least from his perspective. Many had been eliminated because the information they'd provided was too vague or their suggestions too far-fetched. In some cases, it was clear from later file entries that their questions and concerns were not relevant to the investigation. He'd followed up on every call in which a missing girl had been reported. In one instance, dental records were not a match for Jane Doe's. In another, the police advised the sheriff's department that the girl in question was a chronic runaway and had returned home within days. In a third case, the mother of the subject called and informed investigating officers her daughter was alive and well. Stacy had even tried using telephone numbers listed in the reports in hopes of contacting persons whose information seemed pertinent, but many numbers were out of service or had been reassigned to other parties. Having reached the last of the reports, I went through again, consigning the pertinent dates to a stack of blank index cards, converting the facts from their narrative form to disconnected bits of information that I'd analyze later. When I finally closed the file and looked at my watch, it was only 7:15, still early enough to catch up with Dolan at CC's. I pulled on my shoes, grabbed my jacket and shoulder bag, and headed out to my car. The Caliente Café, or Cici's as it's known, is a neighborhood bar that offers an extensive menu of American dishes with Spanish surnames. The food was probably the management's attempt to keep the patrons sufficiently sober to drive home without incurring any DUIs. The surrounding property had undergone a transformation since my last visit 2 years before. The restaurant is housed in an abandoned service station. The gasoline pumps and below-ground storage tanks had been removed at the time of the conversion, but the contaminated soil had simply been blacktopped over, and the resulting quarter acre of tarmac was used to provide patron parking. As time went on, the neighbors had begun to complain about the virulent seepage coming up from the ground, a chemical molasses fierce enough to darken the soles of your shoes. In the thick of summer heat, the asphalt became viscous and smelled like oolong tea, which is to say, smoldering tires. In winter, the surface seized up, buckling and cracking to reveal a mealy substance so caustic it generated nosebleeds. Stray cats were subject to racking coughs on contact. Wandering dogs would suddenly stagger in circles as though in the grip of neurological dismay. Naturally, the owner of the property wasn't interested in paying the hundreds of thousands of dollars required to excavate this hellishly befouled soil. But the EPA had finally stepped in, and now the parking lot had been uprooted in an effort to remove all the contaminated dirt. In the process, numerous Chumash Indian artifacts had been uncovered, and the site was suddenly embroiled in a dispute among several parties: the tribe, the landowner, the city, and the archaeologists. So complex was this litigation that it was impossible to tell who was siding with whom. It was a testimony to loyal patrons that for months they'd continued to tromp across this malodorous earth, endured delays and inconveniences, suffered picketers, public warnings, posted notices, fumes, muddy shoes, and the occasional pratfall just to get to their daily drinks. The parking lot was now fenced off, and the path to the front door consisted of a narrow walkway of 2x4 planks laid out end to end. Approaching the establishment, I felt like a gymnast teetering on the balance beam before an ill-timed dismount. The red neon sign that hung above the entrance still hissed and sizzled like a backyard bug light, and the air wafting out smelled of cigarette smoke and corn tortillas fried in last week's lard. A shrieking duet of blender motors was accompanied by castanets of clattering ice cubes being whirled together with tequila and margarita mix. The Caliente Cafe opens at 6 every morning and doesn't shut down until 2 a.m. Its further virtue is that it's located just outside the city limits and thus provides an ever-present refuge for off-duty police officers who need to unwind at the end of a hard day, or after lunch, or after breakfast. As I crossed the threshold, I confess I was hoping to run into a Santa Teresa vice cop named Cheney Phillips. Our long acquaintance had never progressed as far as romance. He had a girlfriend, for one thing. But one could always hope. Rumor had it the two of them had split up, so I figured it wouldn't hurt to put in an appearance. Part of what sparked my interest was the fact I hadn't heard from Robert Dietz in months. He's a semi-retired private eye who worked as my bodyguard in 1983 when a cut-rate hitman was hired to rub me out. Our connection since then has been intense and sporadic, with long, inexplicable intervals between visits. Only 2 weeks before, I'd called him in Carson City, Nevada, and left a message on his machine. So far, he hadn't bothered to call me back, which meant he was either out of the country or had moved on to someone new. Though I was crazy about Dietz, I'd never thought of him as my beau, my steady, my significant other, or my main squeeze, whatever the hell that is. Oh, sure, Dietz and I had fooled around some over the past 4 years, but there was no commitment between us and no promises on either part. Naturally, I was irked at his neglect, even though I was equally at fault. I caught sight of Dolan at the bar. He was wearing a worn brown leather bomber jacket. I paused for a moment to scope out the crowd and saw his gaze slide in my direction. Dolan's been a cop for too many years not to keep an eye on his surroundings, perpetually scanning faces in hopes of a match for one of the mugshots that had once crossed his desk. Off duty or on, no cop can resist the notion of a wholly unexpected felony arrest. He raised a hand in greeting, and I steered a course toward him, threading my way among parties waiting for tables. The stools on either side of him were occupied, but he gave the guys a look, and one of them stood up to make room for me. I placed my shoulder bag at my feet and perched on the stool next to his. The ashtray in front of him was thick with butts, and it didn't take any of my highly developed detecting skills
to note the number of cigarettes he'd smoked, including the one he was in the process of lighting from the still lit. He was drinking Old Forester, and he smelled like a Christmas fruitcake, minus the dried maraschino cherries. He was also snacking on a plate of poppers, batter-fried jalapeno peppers filled with molten cheese. I thought I'd avoid pointing out the continuing error of his ways. There's nothing more obnoxious than someone calling attention to our obvious failings. I said, "I thought I might run into Cheney Phillips. Have you seen him?"
"I think he's in Vegas on his honeymoon."
"His honeymoon? I thought the two of them broke up."
"This is someone new. A gal he met in here 5 or 6 weeks ago."
"You're kidding."
"Afraid not. Anyway, forget him. He's not your type anyway."
"I don't have a type. Of course, I don't have a boyfriend either, but that's beside the point."
"Have a popper."
"Thanks." I took one and bit into it, experiencing the spurt of melted cheese before the heat of the jalapeno set my tongue aflame. The jukebox came to life, and I peered over my shoulder as the strains of a country-western melody line-danced its way across the room. The Wurlitzer was ancient, a chunky, round-bodied contraption with a revolving rainbow of hues, bubbles licking up along its seams. I turned my attention back to Dolan, trying to figure out how much he'd had to drink. He wasn't slurring his words, but I suspect that he was so conditioned by his own alcoholic intake that he'd show no signs of drunkenness, even if he fell off his stool. I wasn't sure if he'd been drinking continuously since lunchtime or had gone home for a nap between cocktails. A glance at the buddy might have been sitting there since 4 p.m. I didn't look forward to working with the man if he was going to be pie-eyed from day to day. His constant smoking didn't appeal to me either, but there was nothing I could do about it. So the less said, the better. "How's Stacy doing? Have you talked to him yet?"
"I called him at 6 and said we'd stop by to see him. Guy's sick of being poked and prodded. Really wants out of there. I guess they'll release him tomorrow once the test results are back."
"Did you tell him your idea?"
"Briefly. I said we'd fill him in when we got there. What'd you think about the case?"
"I really love all that stuff. I usually don't have the chance to see police reports up close."
"Procedure hasn't changed that much the past 20 years. We're better at it now, more thorough and systematic. Plus, we got new technology on our side."
The bartender ambled our way.
"What can I get for you?"
"I'm fine," I said. Dolan lifted his whiskey glass, signaling for a refill. "Aren't we on our way to see Stacy?"
"Right now?"
"Well, there's no point in getting into this if he's not going to agree." I could see Dolan debate his desire for the next drink versus his concern for his friend. He pushed his glass back, reached for his wallet, and pulled out a handful of bills, which he tossed on the bar.
"Catch you later."
I grabbed my bag and followed him as he headed for the door.
"We'll take my car," he said.
"Well, what if you want to stay longer than I do? Then I'm stuck. Let's take both cars and I'll follow. That way I can peel off any time it suits." We wrangled a bit more, but he finally agreed. I was parked half a block down, but he dutifully waited, pulling out just ahead of me as I came up on his left. His driving was surprisingly sedate as we cruised out the 101 in our mini motorcade. I knew if he got stopped and breathalyzed, he'd easily blow over the legal limit. I kept an eye out for cops, half forgetting that Dolan was a cop himself. Once close to St. Terry's, we found street parking within 2 cars of each other on the same block of Castle. It was now fully dark, and the hospital was lit up like a lavish resort. We went in through the rear entrance and took the elevator to 6 Central, the oncology floor. The lights had been dimmed, and the wide, carpeted corridor muffled our footsteps. 3 spare IV poles and 2 blood pressure monitors were clustered against the wall, along with a linen cart, a multi-tiered meal cart filled with trays from the dinner served earlier. I caught sight of a few visitors, but there was none of the lively interplay between patients and family members. Getting well takes work, and no one wants to waste energy on superficial conversation. Passing the nurse's station, Dolan gave a nod to the clerk at the desk. Stacy was in a private room, looking out on a darkened residential street. He seemed to be sleeping, his hospital bed elevated at a 45-degree angle. Poking out from under his red-knit watch cap were wisps of ginger-colored hair. 2 get-well cards were propped upright along the wide windowsill, but there was nothing else of a personal nature. The television screen was blank.
On his rolling bed table, there were a pile of magazines and a paper cup filled with melting ice. Dolan paused in the doorway. Stacy's eyes came open. He waved and then pushed himself up on the bed.
"I see you made it," he said, and then to me, "You must be Kinsey. Nice to meet you."
I leaned forward and shook his hand. His grip was strong and hot, almost as though he were metabolizing at twice the normal rate. While Dolan went about the business of rounding up chairs from opposite corners of the room, I said, "I believe you knew the guys who trained me, Morley Shine and Ben Bird."
"I knew them well. Both good men. I was sorry to hear about Morley's murder. That was a hell of a thing. Have a seat."
"Thanks." Dolan offered me one chair and settled in the other. While the two of them chatted, I studied Stacy. He had small, mild blue eyes, pale brows, and a long, deeply creased face. His color was good, though it looked as though he hadn't shaved for days. He seemed to be in good spirits, and he spoke with all the vigor of an active man. After some preliminary conversation, Dolan brought the subject around to the Jane Doe investigation.
"I gave Kinsey the file to read. We thought we should talk about where we go from here. The doc's still talking about letting you out tomorrow?"
"Looks that way."
The two of them chatted about the case while I kept my mouth shut. I don't know why I'd expected Stacy to resist Dolan's proposition, but he didn't seem at all opposed to our resurrecting the case. He said to Dolan,
"Speaking of which, Frankie Miracle got out. His parole officer, Dench Smallwood, called me and said Frankie found a place in town. By now, he probably has legitimate employment."
"Oh, that'd be a first."
I said, "How does Frankie Miracle fit in? I remember his name from the file." Dolan said,
"He got picked up in Lompoc August 1st, 2 days before Jane Doe's body was found. We always figured he was good for it, though he denied it."
Stacy spoke up.
"He killed his girlfriend in Venice July 29th during a meth binge. He stabbed the woman umpteen times, then he helped himself to her car and all her credit cards and started driving north. She was found a couple of days later when neighbors complained about the smell. Dumbass signed her name to the charge slips every time he stopped for gas," Dolan said. "You'd think someone would notice a Kathy Lee Pierce with no boobs, a mustache, and a 2-day growth of beard."
He shifted in his chair and then rose to his feet.
"You two go on and get acquainted. Time for me to step outside and grab a smoke."
Once Dolan left, I said, "You have a theory why Jane Doe was never identified?"
"No. We expected a quick match. Someone who'd recognize her from the description in the papers. All I can think is she wasn't reported missing, or maybe the missing person's report got buried in the paperwork on some cop's desk. There's probably an explanation, but who knows what it is. By now, it's unlikely we'll ever find out who killed her, but there's a possibility we can get her ID'd and returned to her folks."
"What are the chances?"
"Oh, not as bad as you might think. Once enough time passes, people are more willing to speak up. We might tweak someone's conscience and get a lead that way."
He hesitated, taking a moment to smooth the edges of his sheet.
"You know, Con's wife, Gracie, died a while back."
He mentioned that.
"It hit him hard at the time, but he seemed to be pulling out of it. But ever since he got sidelined with this heart condition, the guy's been in a funk. As long as Gracie was alive, she seemed to keep him in check. But now his smoking and booze consumption are out of control. I've been trying to find a way to get him back on track, so the minute this came up, I jumped on it."
"You're talking about Jane Doe?"
"Right. I was happy you agreed to help. It'll give him a lift. He needs to work."
I smiled with caution, listening for any hint of irony in his tone. Apparently, he didn't realize Dolan had voiced the very same concerns about him. When Dolan returned, he stood looking expectantly from me to Stacy.
"So, what's the game plan? You two have it all worked out?"
"We were just talking about that. Kinsey wants to see the crime scene before we do anything else."
I said, "Right." Dolan said,
"Great. I'll set that up for tomorrow."
Chapter 3.
Dolan picked me up at my place at 10 in his 1979 Chevrolet, Stacy in the back seat. He did an expert parallel parking job and got out of the car. He wore a dark blue sweatshirt and a pair of worn blue jeans. The exterior of the Chevy was a mess. By day, I could see that the once dark brown paint had oxidized, taking on the milky patina of an old Hershey's bar. The back bumper was askew, the left rear fender was crumpled, and a long indentation on the passenger side rendered the door close to inoperable. I managed to open it by means of a wrenching maneuver that made the metal shriek in protest. Once seated, I hauled, trying to get it shut again. Dolan circled the car, shoved the door shut, and secured the lock by bumping it with his hip. I said, "Thanks." Already I was worried about his prowess at the wheel. He leaned in the open window and held his hand out to Stacy.
"Give me your gun and I'll lock him in the trunk."
Stacy winced audibly as he torqued to one side, slipping his gun from his holster and passing it to Dolan. Dolan went around to the rear and tucked the guns in the trunk before he got in on his side. The car's upholstery was a dingy beige fabric that made it difficult to slide across the seat. I remained where I was as though glued in place. I turned so I could look at Stacy, who was sitting in the back seat with a bed pillow wedged behind him. His red knit watch cap was pulled down almost to his brows.
"Threw my pack out," he said by way of explanation. "I was moving boxes last week. I guess I should have done like Mother taught me and lifted with my knees."
Dolan's hiking boots were muddy, and waffle-shaped droppings littered the floor mat on his side. He adjusted the rearview mirror to talk to Stacy's reflection.
"You should have left those for me. I told you I'd take care of them. Quit acting like a mother hen. I'm not helpless. It's a muscle pull, that's all. My sciatica acting up. Even healthy people get hurt, you know. It's no big deal."
In the harsh light of day, I could see that, despite the transfusion, his skin had gray undertones, and the smudges beneath his pale brows made his eyes appear to recede. He was dressed for the outdoors, wearing brown cords, hiking boots, a red plaid wool shirt, and a fisherman's vest. "You want to sit up here?"
"I'm better off where I am. I'm never quite sure when I'm going to need to lie down."
"Well, just let me know if you want to switch places." I tugged at my seatbelt, which was hung up somewhere. I spent an inordinate amount of time trying to get the mechanism to release a sufficient length of belt so I could clip it into place. Meanwhile, Dolan put the car in gear. The engine coughed and died twice, but finally sputtered back to life and we were underway. The interior smelled of nicotine and dog. I didn't picture Dolan as the doggy type, but I didn't want to ask. The floorboards were strewn with gas receipts, discarded cigarette packs, and assorted cellophane bags that had once contained potato chips, cheese and cracker sandwiches, and other heart-healthy snacks. We gassed up at a service station adjacent to the freeway, and then he eased the car out into the traffic, heading north on the 101. As soon as we were settled at a steady speed, Dolan punched in the car lighter and reached for the pack of Camels he had resting on the dash. Stacy said,
"Hey, have mercy. You've got a cancer patient back here."
Dolan again angled the rearview mirror so he could see Stacy's face.
"That doesn't seem to stop you from smoking that pipe of yours."
"The pipe's purely recreational. At the rate you smoke, you'll be dead before me."
Dolan said, "Nuts,"
but left the pack where it was. Stacy tapped me on the shoulder.
"See that? The guy looks after me. You'd never guess that about him."
Dolan's smile barely registered, but it softened his face. After the town of Colgate, the railroad tracks and the highway ran parallel to the ocean. To the north, the Santa Ynez Mountains loomed dark and gray, dense with low-growing vegetation. There were scarcely any trees, and the contours of the foothills were a rolling green. Much of the topography was defined by massive landslides, sandstone, and shale debris extending for miles. Dolan and Stacy conducted a conversation that consisted of fishing and hunting stories, endless accounts of all the creatures they'd shot, hooked, trapped, and snagged, gutted, skinned, and toted home. This, with men, passes for a load of fun.
We sped past the state beach park, where camping sites consisted of adjacent oblongs of asphalt that looked suspiciously like parking spaces. I'd seen campers and RVs lined up like piano keys, while the occupants set out aluminum picnic tables and chairs, stoking up their portable barbecues in areas much smaller than the yards they had at home. The children would gorge on hot dogs and potato chips, frolic in the ocean, and then bed down in the car, hair sticky, their bodies infused with residual salt like little cod fillets. For Dolan and Stacy, the sight of the line of campers triggered a recollection of another unsolved homicide. Two teens shot to death on an isolated stretch of beach. After that, they spent time pointing out the various locations where past homicide victims had been dumped. Santa Teresa County had provided a number of such spots. A few miles beyond Gull Cove, Dolan took the turnoff and headed west on California 1. I found myself lulled by the passing countryside. Here the hills were undulating, dotted with shaggy masses of the dark green oaks that marched across the land. The skies were pale blue with only the faintest marbling of clouds. The air smelled of the hot, sun-dried pastures, sprinkled with buttercups, where occasional cattle grazed. The two-lane road wound west and north. From time to time, the route cut through irregular, high-arching rock beds. On one of these stretches, 32 years before, a mammoth boulder tumbled down the slope, shattering the windshield of my parents' car as we passed. I was sitting in the rear playing with my paper doll, scowling because I just bent her left cardboard leg at the ankle. I felt a flash of uncontrollable 5-year-old rage because her foot looked all crookedy and limp. I was just setting up a howl when one of my parents made a startled exclamation. Perhaps the falling rock was briefly visible on descent, bouncing in a jaunty shower of smaller rocks and dirt. There was no time to react. The force of the boulder smashed through the windshield, crushing my father's head and chest, killing him instantly. The vehicle veered right, careening out of control, and crashed against the rocky hill face. The impact flung me forward, wedging me against the driver's seat. From this confining cage of crumpled metal, I kept my mother company in the last long moments of her life. I understand now how it must have felt from her perspective. Her injuries were such that there was no way she could move without excruciating pain. She could hear me whimper, but she had no way to know how badly I was hurt. She could see her husband was dead, and knew she was not far behind. She wept, keening with regret. After a while, she was quiet, and I remember thinking that was good, not knowing she'd left her body and floated off somewhere. Dolan swerved to avoid a ground squirrel that had skittered across the pavement in front of us. Instinctively, I put a hand out to brace myself, and then I focused on the road again, disconnecting my emotions with all the skill of a vivisectionist. It's a trick of mine that probably dates back to those early years. I tuned into the conversation, which I realized belatedly had been directed at me. Dolan was saying,
"You with us?"
"Sure. Sorry, I think I missed that."
"I said, this guy, Frankie Miracle, we talked about last night, he got picked up on a routine traffic stop outside Lompoc. The schmuck had a busted taillight, and when the officers ran the plate, the vehicle came up stolen and wanted by the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Galloway reads him his rights and throws him in the hooscow. Meanwhile, the car's towed to the impound lot. When Galloway sits down to write his report, he reads the APB indicating the registered owner's the victim of a homicide. He goes back over to the jail and tells Frankie he's under arrest for murder and reads him his rights again. 2 days after that, Stacy and I go deer hunting and come across the girl. Yeah, if it wasn't for the taillight, Frankie could have been in Oregon and we might not have tied him to the situation here."
"What about the weapon? I don't remember any mention of it."
"We never found the knife, but judging from the wounds, the coroner said the blade had to be at least 5 inches long. Rumor has it Frankie carried something similar, though he didn't have it on him when we picked him up."
Stacy said,
"He probably tossed it or buried it. Country up there is rugged. Search and rescue came through and did a grid search, but never turned up anything."
He leaned forward and tapped Con on the shoulder, pointing to a side road going off on our right 100 yards ahead.
That's it. Just beyond this bridge coming up.
You think? I remember it was further down along a stretch of white three-board fence.
Oh, maybe so. You could be right about that.
Dolan had slowed from 40 miles an hour to a cautious 15. The two peered over at a two-lane gravel road that cut back at an angle and disappeared from view. It must not have looked familiar because Stacy said,
"Nuh-uh. Try around the next bend. We could have passed it already."
He turned and stared out the rear window. In the end, Dolan made a U-turn and we circled back, making a second slow pass until they settled on the place. Dolan pulled onto a secondary lane, gravel over cracked asphalt that followed the contours of a low-lying hill. Directly ahead of us, I could see where the road split to form a Y. A locked gate barred access to the property with its no trespassing signs. On the near side of the gate and to the right, a Jeep was parked. "Where's Grayson Quarry?" I asked, referring to the crime scene as designated on the official police reports.
"Around the bend to the right, about a quarter of a mile," Dolan said.
As he edged over on the berm and set the handbrake, an elderly gentleman in jeans, cowboy boots, and a leather hat emerged from the Jeep. He was small and wide, with a full-sized Santa belly pushing at the buttons of his Western-style shirt. He approached our car, walking with a decided limp. Dolan cut the engine and got out on his side. Stacy murmured,
"That's Arne Johansson, the ranch foreman. I called and he agreed to meet us to unlock the gate."
By the time Stacy eased out of the back seat, I'd emerged from the passenger side and shoved the car door with one hip. Now that Dolan was in the open air, he lit a cigarette. Stacy moved toward the old man and shook his hand. I noticed he was making an effort to appear energetic.
"Mr. Johansson, this is nice of you. I'm Stacy Oliphant with the County Sheriff's Department. You probably don't remember, but we met in August of 69, back when the body was found. This is Lieutenant Con Dolan from Santa Teresa PD. He's the fellow who was with me. Two of us were up here to hunt when we came across the girl."
"I thought you looked familiar. Good seeing you."
"Thanks, we appreciate your help."
The old man's gaze drifted in my direction. He seemed puzzled at the sight of me.
"Like to see some ID if it's all the same to you."
This was directed at the guys, though his eyes remained on me. Stacy moved his jacket aside to expose the badge attached to his belt. His badge specified that he was retired, but Johansson didn't seem to notice, and Stacy didn't feel compelled to call it to his attention. Dolan rolled his cigarette to one corner of his mouth and took out a leather bifold wallet with his badge, which he held up. While Johansson leaned forward and studied it, Dolan took out a business card and handed it to him. Johansson tucked the card in his shirt pocket and glanced at me slyly.
"She's with us," Dolan said.
I was perfectly willing to show him a copy of my license, but I liked Dolan's protectiveness and thought I'd leave well enough alone. This time, when the old man's eyes returned to mine, I looked away. I pegged him as a throwback, some old reprobate who believed women belonged in the kitchen, not out in the real world, going toe-to-toe with men. He had to be in his 80s. His eyes were small, a watery blue. His face was sun-toughened, deeply creased, and bristling with whiskers that showed white against his leathery skin. He shifted his attention to Dolan's cigarette.
"I'd watch that if I was you. It's fire country up here."
"I'll be careful."
Johansson took out a set of keys, and the four of us walked over to